Achieving zero waste will force us to look for other ways of finding happiness and require us to distinguish between what we desire and what we need to be happy. More laws don't work. Economics plays into it. The zero waste solution is a fascinating, fact-filled, and idea-rich book by Paul Connett, Untrashing the Planet, One Community at a Time, How Cities and Towns Around the World Are Saying No to Incinerators and Wasteful Product Design, and Yes to Radical Recycling, Reuse Entrepreneurs, and the Jobs They Create. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned for part one. This is Tributaries.
But anyway, I have a lot to say.
We did an interview years ago about the fluoride issue.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was many years ago, and so I'm so pleased. We spoke about perhaps doing a show sometime later, and now here we are in the future.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
great.
Definitely appreciate your work. Well, Paul, let me thank you first for joining us, and thank you for writing The Zero Waste Solution, Untrashing the Planet, One Community at a Time. There's certainly nowhere to go for blame at this point, is there?
No. I think things have been in transition on this front, on the waste front, with the turn of the century, this new 21st century. As you probably know, I've been involved with waste management issues for 28 years, and that began with a battle against a local incinerator where I used to live in Canton, New York, which then sort of became a national movement against incineration. And the focus in those days, quite frankly, was on toxicity. The dioxin emissions, the heavy metal emissions, what you do with ash, etc. And I think now in the 21st century, whilst there are some toxic questions left to be resolved, the issue is more about sustainability. And which is nice from a psychological point of view of an activist like myself, because it represents a shift from saying no to incineration, or in Italy, no incineratore, to yes, yes to zero waste, and yes to zero waste, because it is a stepping stone to sustainability.
It sounds so much more emphatic and better in Italian for some reason.
Passione.
Yes. You bring up so many amazing points, and anyone who is interested in being involved either personally or within the community, I can't recommend that you read Paul's book enough. But one of the things you mentioned in your book that really stuck with me was how just getting a little vote and saying no was just a temporary fix for what's really going on. And maybe
absolutely
you can...
true. If I turn the clock back to the 1980s, so 1985 to 1995, about 300 incinerators were stopped in the United States and Canada, largely through grassroots action. And the battles were very intense. And I now look back and say to myself, that was the easy part. Stopping incineration is the easy part. Most people are alarmed. They don't want the threat. They work night and day to overcome the threat, and they're usually successful. But the question is, what do you do after you've stopped the incinerator? And I'm afraid that many communities or many community organizers went to sleep after they beat the incinerator and often left the community continuing landfilling or exporting their waste to some distant landfill in a poor community. And this time round, as we see new incinerator proposals sadly being introduced in the United States and certainly in Canada at the moment, I am determined that when I help communities, I say to them, look, just don't bring me in to stop the incinerator. I'm tired of doing that. I want to leave this community with your commitment to work for zero waste and to work for sustainability, then it's worth my while continuing this thing, because we can't just keep reinventing these battles every 20 years.
Yes, yes. And we're going to speak a lot more about other things than the incinerators, but while we're here, they are certainly one of the groups that have a way of greenwashing. You know, they'll start calling it something else. It's like these little fertilizer companies that drive around the little towns in these brightly colored little trucks, and, you know, how cute. It looks so great. You almost want to go buy an ice cream cone from them, you know, and here they are totally poisoning our communities.
Right. They've used a whole bunch of names to avoid using incineration. I've joked that this is a company that's ashamed of its own name, incinerator. They are trash incinerators. But no, when we first started getting involved, they called them resource recovery plants, and then they called them waste to energy plants, and then energy from waste plants, and then more technical thermal oxidation plants. And now we have a new wave of proposals, which strictly speaking are not incinerators, plasma arc, pyrolysis, gasification. But they, all of those last things I've mentioned typically are two stages. One, they convert the solid to gas, then they burn the gas. So I think a more appropriate name in this case would be gasifying incinerator or pyrolyzing incinerator and so on. But yes, they have a lot of ways of greenwashing. And the one that is proving really troublesome at the moment is places like Vancouver are declaring themselves as a zero-waste city, and yet they are building incinerators. And the way they've got around this is to talk about zero waste to landfill, meaning you recycle as much as you can, and then you burn the rest or you destroy the rest, which is a complete undermining of the concept of zero waste.
Yes.
It reminds me of what the incinerator industry did during our battles in the 1980s and 1990s. They talked about integrated waste management, which, just as you said, gives that nice cozy feeling. Integrated waste management. Who could possibly be against integrated waste management? But basically, their approach was, well, we give a bit of recycling to the environmentalist, and we give the incinerator to the incinerator industry, and we all live happily ever after. And, of course, we had to fight hard against that and try to make it clear that recycling was an opponent of, well, certainly a combination of recycling and composting, was an alternative to incineration, not to be married with incinerator. And I said humorously at the time, if you believe in integrated waste management, you believe that if you put a pig and a lamb in bed together, you're going to get a little piglet or whatever. A tiglet. I think I said tigers. Someone corrected this for the book. I said if you put a tiger and a lamb together in a bed, you believe in integrated waste management, you're going to get little tiglets.
Right.
I said you don't get little tiglets. You get bloody pieces of lamb as the tiger devours the lamb, and just as the incinerator industry devours the alternatives.
Yes, well, many years ago now, maybe, gosh, 20 years ago, a couple of friends of mine started a business to help old corporations come into the times. And they started working with a chemical company, and they thought they were being great. They were every year trying to reduce the accidents in their chemical plants, which sometimes were quite horrific. And so they go, well, we're working down to a 7%. And my friends, when they got together with them, they said, okay, do you want to name who those 7% are? Would you like to put their names and faces on a list here? Why don't we shoot for zero?
Yes, yes.
And so, yes, let's shoot for the zero. And, of course, it's a huge undertaking. We have so much opportunity. We can move with some kind of forethought about our actions and what happens afterwards and incorporate that into our actions.
Absolutely, and I think I think what you said is absolutely true, and it's very much part of the educational process. And I think our problem is we can't distinguish between being clever and being wise. We have lots of rewards for people that are clever. We have rewards in industry. We have rewards in academia. You get PhDs for being very, very clever. But there's very few rewards for being wise. And yet, if you look at it, you can see where we've been extremely clever and then been unwise. One thing that comes to mind in our business is plastics. The people that developed plastics were brilliant. They got Nobel Prizes for it. Carruthers got a Nobel Prize from DuPont for the invention of nylon. But then you come to the lack of wisdom when we use these plastics for items which we only use for a few minutes or a few seconds. Wine glasses made of plastic, plates, cups, saucers, knives and forks, plastic bags, plastic bottles. We use these things for a very short time, and yet one of the best properties of plastics is their durability. So here's a clever invention, but used unwisely. And again, if you think about incineration, I think the engineers who've attempted to reduce the emissions of dioxin to nanograms out of incinerators, very, very clever. But are they wise to try to perfect this technology in the 21st century when the real task is not to destroy things, but to recover things? That's where the wisdom comes in, and it's the wisdom of organization, the wisdom of education, the wisdom of industrial design, better design. That's the challenge, the challenge.
Yes, and that mentality of burn, bury, or cart our trash out to sea is not unlike the medical industry that wants to slash and burn. And I'm wondering, as things change, you know, we mentioned the plastic just now, and coincidentally, when DuPont came upon this plastic, that's when hemp was made illegal, and plastic was able to take over where hemp was now not able to. And, you know, we're all grateful for that for about 2 seconds, I think. What if we do have hemp processed into everything that it can be? Is that as problematic as a plastic as far as, well, okay, we're done with that now? Or is it truly, do you think, a good revitalized solution?
I wouldn't call myself an expert on hemp, but what I've heard about it, about the multi-uses for every part of the plant, is very exciting. I think there may be downsides. I think there's downsides when you start to use large areas for growing a material for not eating, you know, not an edible crop when we need to feed a lot of people. And, of course, one would be concerned about the wholesale use of pesticides, and we don't want Monsanto jumping in here and genetically engineering the hemp plant or whatever. So I think, yes, there are some downsides there. But I think in the main, it's very, very, very positive. And I think in terms, going back to that issue from the clever, wise business, it's a question of asking the right questions. And often we end up being clever and not wise because the questions that we ask are too small. And now in the 21st century, we really have to ponder whether there's going to be any lifestyle left at all at the end of this century. We've got to ask the right questions. And always, in every single thing that we do, any big thing that we do in the future, the question must be, is it sustainable? We've run out of time for short-term gains and long-term losses.
Yes, well, that certainly is the question. And in having that question in front of us, we need to cut to the chase that the issues are always about economics. And I would argue that it's about economics, not regulations. It's like approaching something from a negative point of view, I don't think can go as far as it can if you started from another starting point.
Absolutely. And I would say what I find intriguing is that some of the best books are written about the environment have been written by economists. I think of E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful. Still, I think one of the best books written about the environment, although it was supposed to be about economics. Economics as if people mattered. And then I think of also Paul Hawkins' book, The Ecology of Commerce, where I think he got everything right. And I have suggested, knowing very little about economics, I should say, certainly no training in economics, that given enough time or given enough space, economics and ecology are the same thing. In other words, planetary economics is planetary ecology. And it's from the same root, isn't it? Eco, house. We look after our house. If we are talking about the economics of our planet, it's the same as the ecology of our planet. We have to learn to adapt all our processes, all our industries, etc., to fit into nature's overriding umbrella. We have to live within the biosphere and not put it out of whack.
In saying this now, you cited early on in your book California and Italy, and there was one other place initially in your book you mentioned. And so we have California as a state that has taken recycling and zero waste to heart, but they also have some of the most insane regulations, and I think they've kind of gone broke as partly as a result of all of that.
Yeah, well, I don't know much about those insane regulations in California. All I know is that they put through one regulation in California in the 1990s, and it basically every community had to get 50% diversion from landfill by 2000. And that was the spark. That little bit of vision there was the spark. And what happened was that many communities not only achieved that 50% long before 2000, some, I think, by 1996, there were about 300 communities that were getting 50%. But what they found was that by doing this, they were saving money. And that's always a telling, you know, going back to economics.
Yes, yes.
They're on the same side, saving money, creating jobs. And so they were already saying, you know, why stop at 50%? Why not go 60, 70, 80%? Because they were saving money, creating jobs. This is obviously the right way to go. So that regulation was good.
Yes.
Maybe you can help me with some of the regulations which you think are insane, and I can comment on them.
I'm not saying so much that regulations are insane, but when everything has to be so regulated, then those regulations have to be monitored. And, you know, that's where I think we sort of lose sight of the reality of it. In speaking right now about landfills, you speak in your book about interim landfill. And could you talk about that and how it differs from a landfill and what you see there?
Yes, actually, very early on in my waste days, going back to 1985, 86, it became very clear to me that everybody agreed on one thing, and that was all landfills eventually leak. The EPA has said as much several times. So even when the stuff you're putting into the landfill is absolutely horrible, like radioactive waste, eventually all landfills leak. And at that point, I made a logical jump, which to say, well, if all landfills leak, instead of putting all this effort into controlling what comes out, which seems to be futile in terms of capturing all the gases which are emitted, all the leachate that's released, and all the particles which blow off the surface and so on, we have to control what goes in to the landfill. So that was an early idea, if you like, a notion that I had right from word go. And now that's catching up with us on a different front. And that is, in order to get to zero waste, we need to do what nature does brilliantly, which is to introduce a feedback mechanism. Nature doesn't make any waste because when something begins to look as if it's going to become a huge pile of waste, then something else will come along and stop the production of that material or consume that waste very, very quickly, rapidly, either in the ecosystems or in our own bodies. And I guess it's in our own bodies that I'm most familiar with as a biochemically trained scientist. I'm absolutely staggered by the brilliant way that nature uses feedback mechanisms to regulate and control everything. So, for example, if you produce a metabolite, a breakdown product from food or anything else, and it starts to accumulate in the body, then that metabolite will frequently switch off the enzyme at the first step of the process in its production. And so in that way it regulates the level of these things to the level that which you need. Now, we have a waste problem because we just have refused to use feedback mechanisms. We use landfills and incinerators to make our problems disappear. And the problem I would define in this case is packaging and products that the community cannot recycle, reuse, or compost. Along comes the magic machine and says, we will make those disappear. You don't have to think about these things. And we in industry can continue to manufacture these plastic switches, watches, whatever these blodgets are that they're producing, which are accumulating in the billions. And let me give you a very specific example. Right now in Italy, we have a company called Lavazza that makes single-serving coffee, a capsule which contains coffee, and you pull down a lever, it puts a hole in the capsule, you've got exactly the right amount of coffee to make an excellent cup, a single-serving cup of coffee, but you're left with a plastic container which no one can recycle, it's contaminated, blah, blah, blah. So rather than focus on that bad design, along comes the incinerator and says, oh, we can burn all these plastic things and get a few penny worth of energy. Now, why this, what you asked the question about the interim landfill. In front of the interim landfill, which remember, in the zero waste strategy, we want to get smaller and smaller and smaller. We want the amount of material that goes into that landfill over the next 10, 15, 20 years to get smaller and smaller and smaller, getting closer and closer to zero waste. We build in front of the landfill a residual screening and zero waste research facility. Now, the first part of that already exists in Nova Scotia. They've done a great job outside Halifax building a very large residual screening facility. And the trucks which bring the waste in from Halifax and the surrounding areas, they cannot dump that directly into the landfill. It must go into this screening separation facility. And they do several things with that facility. The paid workers pull out more recyclables, magnets pull out more metal, steel, etc. They pull out more toxics like paint cans and so on, although in Nova Scotia they have excellent household hazardous waste collection, drop-off facilities every Saturday, so they reduce that extensively already. But then the dirty organic fraction, things like diapers and kitty litters, they get all the way to the end of the conveyor belts, untouched by any human being. And then they go through a shredding operation. And this shredded material, which is a lot of plastics and some organic material, is composted above ground for 18 days to stabilize it biologically before it's landfilled. In other words, attempt to minimize the problem that this stuff is going to have when it goes underground by doing a lot of stabilization above ground.
And so what is involved in the stabilization of something like that?
Well, your organics are converted into a very dirty topsoil in this case. It would be a topsoil contaminated with plastics and so on. But you've taken the putrescible materials, which otherwise is going to stink for you, and in the landfill it's going to produce methane, it's going to produce other gases, and it's going to produce leachate, which gets into the groundwater. But by and large, you can stabilize a great deal of that material, so it's not going to produce all those nasties. All the while, of course, making sure that you are doing what you can at the front end, minimizing the material that's coming into that residual facility. And that's where the second part comes in. The second part is to put into such a facility a zero-waste research facility where you use, local professors and students from local universities or technical colleges who are interested in sustainability. They will be studying this non-recyclable material and maybe find some local uses for some of the material, but in the main, be saying to industry or suggesting better industrial designs to industry for this packaging and products. And the overall message, remembering this is where community responsibility at the back end is going to be meeting industrial responsibility at the front end. The community says to industry, look, if we can't reuse it, recycle it, or compost it, you shouldn't be making it. We need better industrial design for the 21st century. So that is the nub of this thing. It's the feedback mechanism. And I'd like, if you want to put it into one transparency, one PPT slide, you have community responsibility at the back end, which is reduce, reuse, recycle, and compost, the three R's and the C, and industrial responsibility at the front end, where we introduce the fourth R, redesign. And that's where I think that's the nub of the zero waste message, because a lot of the stuff that we talk about in that book has been happening for 10, 15, 20, 30 years already. I think most communities are familiar with source separation, door-to-door collection, composting, recycling, reuse and repair, waste reduction initiatives, pay-by-bag system. All these things are going now in different places to different extents. But what we still don't have is right in the center of things, the feedback mechanism, the Zero Waste Research Center, putting pressure onto industry to play its part.
Yes, and we certainly have things set up and moving forward regarding GMOs. Vitamin Cottage here in Colorado, they won't handle anything with GMOs, and it would just be a small shift left or right from that to not handling products that have just overt chemicals, or they can't be recycled very easily. And
yeah,
it's a good way, once again, hit the pocketbook and then things can change.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned GMOs, which is another thing that drives me crazy. It is another classic case of our amazing arrogance as a species. To think that we can come in with a pitiful amount of knowledge and sort of change the genes in our living environment. Another very good example of being very, very, very clever with gene manipulation, but very, very unwise to sprinkle it on the planet before we have an inkling of understanding of what this is going to do. And it reminds me of the people that thought they were doing well by introducing rabbits to Australia. Ask the Australians what they think about rabbits. Ask the New Zealanders what they think about the possum, also introduced. So we have to be much more careful, and that wisdom is vision. It's long-term thinking. It's asking the right questions. And yes, when you talk about Monsanto and GMOs and so on, and what the public can do and grassroots action, one of the reasons I want to see those professors and students getting involved with the nitty-gritty, with getting their hands dirty, with waste and bad industrial design, is we need them, the professors and students, linking the success, which I'm sure we can get, and the psychological success we can get by making huge advances with waste management, with the zero waste program and link everything to other aspects of sustainability. Composting obviously links to sustainable agriculture, fighting the use of pesticides, fighting the use of wasting topsoil, wasting chemical fertilizers, and also, of course, fighting GMOs. So that's a big linkage there. Then another linkage is with deconstruction companies getting into the act and providing useful materials for reuse and repair centers in the form of lumber and bricks and doors and windows and you name it. With deconstruction, we can link to green architecture and sustainable architecture. And, of course, sustainable energy, which means no, incineration is not sustainable, but anaerobic digestion to produce some energy would be sustainable. So there are many, many linkages there which we need our brightest minds to be working on. And I just find that waste is just a wonderful place to start, but it's not the place we're going to end.
And another good place to start is bringing waste and using it as the verb that it is.
Yes.
And not just
not
thinking of it
not
as a noun.
Not a noun. Waste
right.
is a verb, yes. There's no such thing as waste. This is Mary Lou Deventer, who with her husband Dan Knapp have done so much to protect the language or rescue the language from the waste industry. They've done so much, and that was one of the things that Mary Lou would say, is it's not waste until it's wasted. Waste is a noun. It's not a verb. She's been very, very good with that. And, of course, they both together have got this wonderful Urban Ore, a reuse and repair center in Berkeley, California, which has been the model for so many of its kind around the world.
More with Paul Connett next week. His book is The Zero Waste Solution. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, it's Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.